This is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 21. Girl Meets Dirt was born of the land, grew limbs through storms, gained strength with rain, knowledge with history, rootedness with dirt under her fingernails. Seedlings rose and bore fruit, and as she watched, curious and hungry, she learned the art of stretching bounty into winter. This is where the story ends, it always ends, but begins anew, with worn muddy boots and kitchen clogs, a journey in steps, stems, pear seeds, plum pits, and apple flesh, a journey to the fruit of the matter and back on one island farmette. This is the story of Girl Meets Dirt and its creator, Audra Query Lawler. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast. Welcome to another edition of the Pure Green Podcast. This episode is a special edition because I'm talking with Audra Query Lawler of Girl Meets Dirt, an artisanal preserves company that crafts its spoon preserves using heirloom fruits that have quite a history. Audra is a lovely, gentle soul, and I immensely enjoyed our talk together. The introduction to the show that you just heard was written by Audra, and this small snippet is how she sets the stage for Girl Meets Dirt. This episode is special because we featured Audra in Volume 10, The Heritage Issue, which is freshly printed and hitting subscribers' mailboxes around the world as we speak. The feature was photographed by Sonia Lyon, a beautifully talented photographer, and her husband Daniel also created a short film. Volume 10 is available now for purchase or subscription. You can purchase on our website at puregreenmag.com/subscribe, and you can view the video on our site as well. In this interview, Audra and I talk about the evolution of her life, which took her from a high-powered career in finances on Wall Street to the quiet serenity of Orcas Island, part of the San Juan Islands in Washington State. Audra has yearned for a change of pace for years, and when she and her husband finally committed, the move was fairly spontaneous, but luckily all has worked out for the best. While getting used to her new home, Audra began gardening and developed a feel for digging in the dirt, and her relationship with growing her own food and the ebb and flow of the seasons and the bounty they provided. During that time, she also learned that the island had a rich history as a major fruit-growing region during the turn of the century. This industry eventually withered, and 100-year-old, wizened, weathered old trees are all that remain of the former orchards. But those trees are still healthy and still produce reams of gorgeous fruit that sadly, before Audra arrived, largely went to waste. But no longer. Audra and I talk about this rich history, the idea of terroir, the importance of working with real, authentic ingredients, and the evolution of Girl Meets Dirt. Here's Audra. So you came from a high-powered job on Wall Street in a really high-energy city, New York, and you shifted that over to a quieter existence. I mean, really dramatically, you're on an island, after all. And so what was your life like before, and what was the impetus that caused such a dramatic shift?
Yeah, it was a huge change. I guess I could have made it more incremental by moving to, say, a smaller city in the Northwest, but I was just at a point in my life and in my relationship with my then fiance that we really needed to seriously turn our lives upside down. I worked on Wall Street for 10 years in what I like to call an accidental career. I studied out at Seattle University, so I'm a Northwest girl at heart. So I did grow up out here, and I grew up with my family boating in the islands that I now live in. So I always harbored kind of a fantasy about being out here. And it was always any of my escape fantasies involved these islands. But it never seemed like something that was practical. I mean, particularly given the career that I had found myself in, it certainly wasn't somewhere that I could go and continue to do what I was doing. I had actually studied, it was more on like sustainability and economics as an undergraduate, and was focused on Latin America, and kind of randomly wound up with an internship in New York City working for an investment bank in Latin American economic research. And that ended up I ended up moving out there for the summer, having actually quite a terrible experience, working my tail off, but being thrown into an environment where, you know, someone who had never, I'd actually never taken a finance class before, had no interest in banking, really was interested in the social justice side of things. But having this experience, I felt like it was opening my eyes to, you know, a side of the world that was so inundated with power and could answer a lot of questions that I had about the world that I had to pursue it. So I ended up taking a full-time job offer after that summer internship, and one thing led to another, and I tried to leave every couple of years, and whether it was relationships in my life or different job offers, something kept me there for a lot longer than I thought I would stay. Manhattan life is certainly different than anything I experience day to day here. You know, you're talking about tiny little apartments that you pay $3,000 a month for that you're sharing with several people, and commute, you know, long commutes on the subway and super long hours. I you know, 12 hours was a good day if I was lucky. And it really began to wear away at my soul, and my creativity. I've always been a writer and love to write and love to cook. And I never, had much time for that during my 10 years out in New York. So as the time wore on and I met someone, my now husband, Jerry, who's from Ireland, and about 2 years into our relationship, he had an opportunity where he was walking away from a business that he had started. And he's a pretty intense guy, you know, go-getter, really wanted to take the world by storm. But this opportunity made him sit out from work for a while. And all of a sudden, he started thinking about living a finer quality of life and how we could do that. And he knew, since I had met him, when I met him, I was actually moving to San Francisco. I was about to take a job offer with another bank just to get myself out west to take that first leap. But I met him and we fell in love and he asked me to stay and I stayed. So as part of that arrangement, he promised me that he would get me out west as soon as possible. You know, I never imagined it would be out west to an island on 5 acres with a farm, but life works in mysterious ways. So, you know, to kind of make a more complicated story short, I wanted to leave my job. I was ready to leave. At that time, I was working for Goldman Sachs. I had started on the first day of a financial crisis. And I had come from Merrill Lynch, which then basically was at the hot seat of everything. So it was, and I worked there for 2.5 years. All very intense. So I was definitely ready to leave. So when my husband started kind of dropping hints about being ready to leave Manhattan, I took the bull by the horns and really supported it. So we actually got married out in Roach Harbor, which is on a neighboring island to where we live now, in September of 2010. And he started talking about possibly moving west in October 2010. And we were moved into our house on Orcas Island late January 2011. So once we made the decision, we made it happen really, really fast and just both basically quit our jobs, packed up a moving truck and moved cross country with our two dogs and said, let's figure this out. Had no jobs waiting for us, just decided to turn our lives upside down and see what we can make of ourselves.
Wow, that's, you know, with no job waiting for you, that's quite a commitment. But at the same time, it's freeing because, you know, the options are limitless. So why Orcas Island?
So Orcas, when we started having this conversation, it was like, well, how about San Francisco? And we thought fairly quickly about San Francisco and I said, you know what? Life isn't going to be much easier for us in San Francisco. We're both, at least one of us is going to have to get another fairly high paying job. Real estate's very expensive. We're not going to be able to buy anything. So then we said, well, how about Portland or Seattle? And my husband, being a European and living in Manhattan also for 10 years, felt at the time that they were somewhat provincial, even though I had grown up in this area. I grew up in Vancouver, Washington. But he also felt that if we move out to Seattle or Portland, we're still going to have to completely reinvent ourselves. We're not going to be able to get jobs right away in the industry. We're going to have to start over. So if we're going to start over, why don't we go exactly where we want to go? And I had always harbored this fantasy for the San Juan Islands. Orcas Island is one of the islands in the archipelago of the San Juan Islands. It's one of the four ferry-serviced islands. So I was familiar with it from the harbors because I grew up boating with my family and visiting the harbors as a child. But I didn't know the town at all and knew nothing about the community. I knew a bit about San Juan Island, a neighboring island, again, about the harbors and because we got married out there. But we really chose Orcas because of the topography. It's an absolutely stunning island in terms of the diversity of terrain. On one side of the island, it's shaped like a horseshoe. On one side of the island, you have a very large state park called Moran State Park, which houses Mount Constitution, which is the highest peak in the archipelago. So it's an outdoorsy person's wonderland. There's three freshwater lakes that are beautiful for swimming during the summers, tons of hiking and mountain biking and places to kayak and canoe and stand up paddleboard. And at the time we were super into, my husband and I actually met kind of doing triathlons together. So we were really into, swimming, biking and running, and love things like trail running. So, Orcas just kind of seemed like a no-brainer because it had this access to the outdoors. And at the time, I actually had no idea of the fruit-growing history of the islands. I knew there was a strong farming community, but that could be, you know, said of any of the islands in the archipelago just because of the remoteness. We tend to grow a lot of our own produce. But in the end, it really was a gamble because we had no idea what the community was like. We didn't know anyone here. We bought our property after seeing it one dreary, rainy December, dark December afternoon, and just had a feeling about it.
Wow. You went for lifestyle then and just put your faith in that everything else would come after. That's remarkable. So then how did Girl Meet Dirt come around? What was the inspiration there?
So Girl Meets Dirt was an evolution. It certainly wasn't something that I thought long and hard about and planned. And about probably 6 months into moving here, I started to blog. And the blog at the time was called MinnowCreekLane.com, which was just the name of our street. And then as I started writing, I was basically writing about our transition to country life and the experience of being a city slicker and all the kind of crazy first-time experiences of moving to the country and the culture shock, and also the experience of growing my first garden. We bought a property with 5 acres, and it had a starter garden ready to go. So that first season that we were there, we moved in January. So that spring, I was in the garden almost every day getting things ready and for the first time really starting everything from seed and preparing for a summer full of vegetables and the fruit. We inherited a bunch of fruit trees as well that we had grown ourselves. I started writing a bit about that experience of working the land and getting my hands dirty, so to speak. And somewhere along the line, the idea of Girl Meets Dirt came to me. And I started using that as a tagline for the blog that I was working on. So within a few months, I ended up transitioning the blog to Girl Meets Dirt and calling it that. So I was writing under that moniker for probably about a year and a half, almost 2 years before the idea of a business really settled. So I started to write a lot about, because we had inherited a bunch of fruit trees on the property that we owned, come fall, I was inundated with Italian plums and Shiro plums and Orcas pears and Bosque pears. And having not really had access to that type of fruit before, I was a bit clueless on what to do with it. So I threw myself into my cookbooks and basically taught myself how to preserve. And in the process of teaching myself to preserve, I totally fell in love with the idea of preparing jams and spreads and conserves that in the fall or, late summer and fall that I could then enjoy throughout the year. And in the middle of winter, bring a little bit of brightness to our days. So I fell in love with preserving. And that's when the idea of, I'd always been interested in food businesses, but I didn't have one. There was not one idea that stuck out. And I knew that if I started a business, I really wanted to be passionate about it and committed to the backstory behind it. So So it wasn't until I started working with the fruit that started to, an idea started to brew in my head. And then after, you know, a season of making preserves, after coming upon my second season, I started just giving things out as gifts randomly, the holidays, neighbors, housewarming gifts, things. And people really responded to it. You know, a lot of people around here preserve, so it's nothing particularly special, but I was a little surprised that I was getting such great feedback given I was kind of brand new at it and just taught myself from scratch. But I was getting a lot of compliments on my preserve. So I started to get the idea that maybe I could start a jam business. I never thought of myself as a jam maker. But the more and more I learned about the orchard history of Orcas Island, the more and more it just seemed like the right thing to do. You know, in the early 1900s, Orcas Island was actually a major fruit producer for the Western U.S. There was a huge movement to putting in swaths of Italian plum trees and Bartlett pears and different types of heirloom varietals. So that industry actually blossomed for a good two decades or so. Until Eastern Washington, which is now kind of the fruit basket of the U.S., discovered irrigation. They basically dammed up the Columbia and were able to irrigate and take advantage of having irrigation and successfully growing fruit in a warmer climate. So the industry in the islands dwindled. But what we have now is we still have a lot of tracts of land and very tiny family farms that are working hard to preserve a lot of this old fruit culture that we have. So everything that I work with is heirloom varietals. Almost all of them are some of these original varietals and original orchards that were planted back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And I was just so inspired by the idea of terroir when it came to fruit. I mean, we talk about it a lot in reference to wine, but we don't think about it with other types of fruit. I mean, why is a pear so different than a grape? You know, I know there's a difference in between the aging of the fruits, but there is something to be said for where the fruit comes from and the particular hillside or valley. So I fell in love with the fruit. I fell in love with preserving and I decided to dive in and start a business. And Girl Meets Dirt was born. I launched, a little over a year ago. I started the process about 6 months prior to that just to get my business license up and running. But I didn't start selling until about this time last year. So we've really only been up and running about a year, which is quite overwhelming to think about. It's grown fast.
Yeah, it has. Things have a habit of moving so quickly. I mean, I'm sure you find when listeners, you're expecting, and when your baby comes, it just time just goes like warp speed. Yes. It's nuts. Yeah. So business and babies, things just take on a whole new life. You touched on in your answer on a few things that I actually had planned to ask you about, but you know, so one was the history of the island, and the second was the terroir and how that is so important to the way that you craft your preserves. So just touching on the first point on that history, how did you become aware of that history? And I think that when we talked previously, you mentioned as well that you're involved in preserving those trees and educating landowners on how to manage them. And so how did all of that start coming into your life?
Well, I think it's something that if you spend any time on Orcas Island, it's really hard not to notice. Just driving around, you notice very old fruit trees, oftentimes in the strangest of places. We actually have one of the main roads through town is called Prune Alley. And, you know, Italian plums are traditionally made into prunes. So in the middle of town, basically, you have the remnants of an old Italian plum orchard just weaving its way through. You know, you go through an area, a beautiful area called Crow Valley, and again, you have these old tracks of Italian plum trees, and almost everybody has some bit of like Bartlett pears or some of the heirloom king apples you'll see everywhere too. So it's hard to ignore. And basically, I just started seeing these fruit trees and started asking questions. And a lot of the farmers are very aware of it. But what's kind of happened is that, you know, obviously these used to be much larger farms, and with the island moving towards, you know, the past century, moving much towards like a tourism economy and a second home type economy, properties have been broken up into much, much smaller pieces. So some of them have been completely uprooted and taken down just to make, build homes or lawns for some people, unfortunately. But there are lots of little bits of it basically remaining on older landowners' properties. But the trick has been is that none of it's really organized. So you do have some small family farms that have some of those older orchard tracts and are doing what they can to promote and sell it. But there's not, there's really, when I started at least, there wasn't a huge market for it simply because there's so much fruit in these islands. And a lot of it, quite frankly, particularly the older fruit, if the trees weren't really well taken care of or pruned over the winter, a lot of that fruit just ended up falling when the windstorms came, you know, towards the end of fall and being eaten up by the deer. So to me, it seemed like an opportunity to take advantage of fruit that wasn't necessarily being brought to its greatest light, and also to help revitalize an industry to some extent. So what we really try and do is we focus almost exclusively on these heirloom varietals, and we work with as many small family farms. There really are no large farms here. Everything's very small, but we work with as many of the organized farmers that we can and buy as much fruit as possible from them. And then we also work with private landowners who don't have perhaps the time to care for their orchards. And we arrange different types of kind of stewardship arrangements where we will care for the trees and do the necessary prunings and in exchange have access to the produce of those trees and the fruit come fall. So it's been an interesting journey. And as word has gotten around, it's become, you know, we've developed relationships all over the islands, not just on Orcas, because this old, you know, orchard growing tradition was true for many of the other islands as well. So we don't focus exclusively on Orcas Island anymore, but we do get the majority of our fruit, I'd say, from Orcas. But yeah, it's been really, really wonderful, actually, to walk into an orchard and see it somewhat in need of care. And then over the course of a season, you know, really, it doesn't take that much. These old trees actually do have a lot left in them and have a lot to produce. You know, do some selective pruning, get somebody in there who knows what they're doing to kind of prune these back into shape. And you end up with such bounty. And it's just, it's so exciting to see. And it's exciting to actually then use that fruit, knowing that perhaps it hadn't been used in many, many years. So I just love the idea that these trees, some of these trees have been producing for 100 years. And I get to then work with this fruit and preserve it into a jar and share it with people all over the United States.
Yeah, it's incredible. And I love that, you know, what you do, it goes beyond just preserves. Like, you are working behind the scenes to preserve, in essence, these unique varietals and make sure that they stay alive and in existence. And so there's that, you know, that element to what you do, I find, is just really inspiring. And it, you know, you have such a story that you can tell about what you do, and the fruits that you use. You know, there's such a unique relationship between your final product, the way you craft your preserves, and the fruit, the unique fruit found on Orcas. It's awesome. It's really cool. So I'm curious, what is your favorite fruit varietal or preserve that you make?
Oh gosh, people ask me that all the time. what I find is I have a hard time choosing a favorite just as much as other people have a hard time choosing a favorite. And it's funny, yeah. I have retailers reaching out to me all the time asking what are my best sellers. And I don't know if they think I'm pulling their chain when I tell them like I don't really have best sellers, like they all sell really well. Mm-hmm. We just deal with, you know, because we don't deal with a ton of different types of fruit. I really focus on quince, pears, apples, plums, and rhubarb. And that's it for the most part. We even avoid the berries simply because it's not what's as well suited to our islands. I really focus on the orchard fruit. Now, all that being said, I do have some favorites just for more local reasons. Our Orcas pear with fresh face food and preserve is very special. It's made exclusively with Orcas pears. There is an Orcas pear, and this is an heirloom varietal that was discovered on Orcas in the 1970s, but it's one of these, they'll call them like treeside fruit trees, basically, that has adapted itself to the island. And become something one of a kind that's particularly suited to the terroir here. So that one's very special. And we use fresh bay leaves from a couple of beautiful bay trees that the chef at the kitchen that I do my production at very carefully grows. So it's nice to use the fresh bay leaves are quite different than dried bay leaves. And it's just wonderful that everything except the sugar and the lemon are coming straight from the island on that product. So I'm also kind of partial to our cutting preserves because they're super unique. You don't see them a lot. So we have two different lines. We've got a line of spoon preserves, which are more like a traditional jam, except they're very fruit forward. And what I mean by that is there's lots of chunks of fruit. So I like to think of our spoon preserves as preserved fruit rather than a jam, which is why I don't even market them as jams. Some of them are even like fruit suspended in syrup. I use very classic French preserving methods, which involves a long maceration in sugar to draw out all the wonderful juices from that fruit. I don't add any water or any other liquids. All the syrup is being generated simply from that fruit being soaked in a sugar in sugar and drawing out those juices. So long maceration time and then a hot quick cook in copper pots yields just something that's very, very unique. The cutting preserves, on the other hand, are quite different. They're highly concentrated fruit purees. If folks out there are familiar with membrillo, which is made of quince or fruit cheese in England, that's what they're inspired by. So they're almost like a paste. Mine aren't quite as dense as you would traditionally see around the globe, or say as a fruit cheese in Europe. I like to keep it still a little spreadable, but the idea with those is that they're slow cooked labors of love. So I take just one fruit varietal. I do it with quince to make a traditional membrillo, but I also do a pear with a bit of pink peppercorn, which is one of my favorites on that side. And I make one with our Italian plums and then also one with crab apples. So these are particularly suited for cheese pairings. They're great because you can just cut out a bit and put it right on your cheese board. It doesn't need a vessel to hold it. It's just great for quick entertaining. Those are also great for any type of flavor starters, making vinaigrettes, sauces, glazes. So it gives you that highly concentrated fruit flavor.
Wow, I'm literally, like, my mouth is watering and I'm breathing in as you say this because I'm like imagining how all of this smells boiling away in your kitchen. And all of this you're self-taught. That's awesome. Quite incredible.
Yeah. You know, my grandfather on my mother's side was a baker. So he passed down some of those skills, but you know, my mother did some freezer jams. I grew up around that, but in terms of actually like the type of preserving that I do now, it was trial and error. Experimentation.
Yeah.
So I've always loved to cook, and you know, my weekends in Manhattan, my favorite thing to do was always to go to the farmer's market. It just was my little bit of peace and respite after a busy week in the city. So to be able to live that full time now, I feel really blessed.
Yeah. It's you're lucky. It, I mean, I'm sure it has its drawbacks just like anything, but it sounds really nice. So, you mentioned as well about the terroir, and I wanted to go back to that just because, you know, I think that's a word that people hear when associating with wine, probably typically, but you know, just that unique flavoring that comes from the earth in which something is grown, and it's obviously essential to that, you know, in this case, fruit trees. And you know, could you explain that a little bit further and the impact that this has on the preserves that you make?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with, you know, it's the same thing when they talk about, you know, say a particular grape that is in a terrain where it has to struggle. And because it has to struggle, it makes, say, a particularly complex wine. I think the exact same can be said of a fruit tree, just based on the environment that it's nourished in. We have so many different microclimates on our island. And so a lot of these orchards are in very different microclimates. And I'll notice a difference between the Italian slums that I get out in an area called Crow Valley, which is kind of this wide open sun-swept valley, and something out, say, in Olga on the other side of the island, which has a bit more of marine impact and has the coastal air hitting it. It's subtle. It's really, really subtle. But I think it's a really important distinction. You know, and I think it's also like our fruit, the fruit that we use compared to if I were to work with a distributor or something and source bulk fruit through Eastern Washington. And it's not to say there's not some wonderful small family farms in Eastern Washington, but some of the much larger bulk growers are using practices that we don't particularly agree with. We use exclusively organically grown fruit. It's not certified organic just because nobody has the means to certify here, but it's a culture on the islands to grow everything organically. We also actually, as a side note, the islands a couple of years ago passed a GMO referendum where we will not allow anyone to grow any GMO seed or fruit trees genetically modified within our islands. So it's quite a fascinating opportunity because we're basically, you know, surrounded by a moat, which is the Salish Sea, that protects us from, you know, cross-transmission of GMO seed that other areas and counties wouldn't be able to prevent simply because of geography. But with regards to terroir, you know, I think about this Bartlett pear orchard that I source almost all my pears from, and it's actually just, it's a neighboring property to ours. It's been around for over 100 years. And I look at the fruit from these trees compared to something that you'd see in the supermarket, and it's night and day. And when you can really taste the difference. And I know that's because these trees have rooted so deeply into the land. You know, think about it, 100 years of the trees growing roots, trying to find the most optimal water source and mineral and nutrient source versus a newer orchard where those roots are going to be more shallow. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, I think time has something to do with it. Obviously location, if something's on a hillside or getting sun or getting windswept or getting that salty sea spray. But it's all something that I try and highlight by doing everything single varietal, which is hard to find out there, actually. You know, particularly the jams and preserves that you see in the grocery store, they could be, you know, if it's say a plum jam, it could be made with 5, 10, who knows, different varietals of plums. But everything we do, we abide by just one varietal in each batch so that you can start to sense like the very different flavors and nuances of those different varietals. So it's just very important to us. It's a way that we connect ourselves to the land and connect ourselves to the farmers that we're working with. You know, to me, the best way to thank them is to give them a jar of preserves made exclusively from a particular varietal of, say, quince from their trees.
Yeah, it's so multifaceted, you know, what you do. And I really admire the, you know, how you craft it with such intention. Like, you really do honor the fruit and the environment that it's grown in. That's, I really applaud you for that. And I hadn't really ever thought of terroir in that sense, as in like the struggle of the plant and the properties that gives it. I always kind of equated it with, you know, how you nourish the earth and the effects that has on it. So that's an interesting distinction. And I love the organic culture that you mentioned, you know, that non-GMO thing. That's pretty, that's rare. And you know, I guess you mentioned that you are sort of isolated there. And so that is helpful. But wow, that's really neat. And it's inspiring that it preserves literally, you know, in every sense of the word, what the island has to offer. That's really great. And so you state on your website as well, quite emphatically, that you don't use commercial pectin. So why is that? And is there something that we should all know about commercial pectin?
You know, the first thing I mentioned when I do talk about that is that there's nothing evil about pectin. But
okay.
So I'll state that first. But what we do is all about the fruit. And so to me, to add in something, additional pectin is totally not necessary. If you look at, and I've experimented working with pectin, but if you look at the traditional methods of preserving, we didn't have access to things like commercial pectin. We worked with the fruit to make it what we wanted it to be. So I feel like everything that we need to preserve a particular type of fruit is given to us with the fruit and with our method. And if sometimes it needs a little extra help, it's very easy to use other types of fruit or things like fresh squeezed lemon juice, which has a lot of natural pectin to give you the set and texture that you're looking for. But it all boils down to the fact that I like to keep things as simple as possible. I don't like to, you know, distort the fruit with too many different types of flavors. And with almost everything that we work with, and we're also blessed because I do work with mostly orchard fruit and heirloom varietals, a lot of these varietals were selected for the very reason that they do have high pectin contents and were shoo-ins to be easily preserved. So there's a lot of people actually, it's funny, you'll meet people out there who only use pectin in their preserves, and then some people who don't use it at all. So it's kind of it's a religion for some people. But in the classic, you know, kind of French style that I follow, there's really no need for it. And if there is, if you're working with something that really is like overripe and doesn't have very much natural pectin, you can supplement with a little lemon juice, or you can add in something like a quince, the juice of a fruit that is very high in pectin, like quince or crab apples. We don't think that you need it.
Yeah.
If you use the methods of doing a long maceration in sugar, mm-hmm. so that really draws out the juices and the pectin from the fruit. The thyme also does. Letting it sit in that for 24 hours helps to work the pectins. And use a mix of, I'm very careful to use a mix of underripe and ripe fruit. So that you get different types of flavor profiles. I also keep the skins of the fruit in almost every product that I work with.
Oh, wow.
So the skins add pectin. And there's different ways to extract different pectin from the fruit by making a juice from the cores and seeds where a lot of the pectin lies.
Yeah, it really doesn't sound like you need it, especially. So it sounds like it's more a style as part of your philosophy rather than anything else. But you know, there's ways to bring that out. So it doesn't, yeah, it truly doesn't sound necessary. And you also talk about the importance of, well, you mentioned earlier about how organic is a huge part of your lifestyle and how you farm and live on the island generally, as well as in your household. And so that naturally extends to the sugar that you use in the preserves. And I love how you write that sugar in moderation can be life-affirming. As someone with a sweet tooth, I really love that. But with anything, when you do choose to indulge, it needs to be with good, real, and pure foods. So, you know, that is carried through to the sugar. What does someone need to know about refined sugar, and why is choosing organic, unrefined sugar the way you do the way to go?
Yeah, so the big deal with refined sugar is that most refined sugar out there is made from sugar beets as opposed to sugar cane. And the real problem with sugar beets is that most of the sugar beets are grown using GMO seeds, so genetically modified seeds. And the problem with that is that the GMO seeds were designed for herbicide and pesticide resistance. So they've been created by big giants like Monsanto for the purpose of having them be, say, Roundup ready, so that you can grow these sugar beets and spray them with all sorts of pesticides and herbicides, and they will be resistant to those, and basically all the, you know, non-desirable weeds will be killed. And it'll keep the desirable weeds. I personally don't like the idea of having any non-natural sprays added to my food. It's part of an ethic that I've learned from growing my own food and learning how to garden organically. My husband and I grow almost all of our own produce just here on our little tract of land. And there are, you know, century-old lessons on how to grow things organically, and it really isn't sustainable to be using things like Roundup and different types of pesticides and herbicides. So the problem with conventional sugar is precisely that. It's exposed to lots of different really nasty things that I don't want in my food. And people would say, oh, you're eating sugar anyways. It's, you know, why does it matter? It's bad for you. But I don't really necessarily believe, like I said, sugar in moderation can be a very life-affirming thing. Sugar's gotten me through a lot of different hard times. Always had a sweet tooth. And sugar really is, it's amazing in terms of its ability. Sugar is what allows us to be able to preserve these fruits. So back to the type of sugar that we use, it's really important for me to use unrefined organic cane sugar. So first, you know, to specify that the sugar is derived from sugar cane, where it naturally has come from. It's organic. It's not grown with any GMO seeds. You don't have that type of issue. And it hasn't been sprayed with any non-organic herbicides or pesticides. What that means, though, you know, there's some pros and cons. A lot of preserve makers out there, you'll notice, actually, interestingly, even if they use organic fruit, they'll use conventional sugar, which kills me.
Yeah.
I don't understand how you can think that you're not ruining the product by promoting something with organic apples, say, and then throwing, you know, bleached white sugar on it. So to us, it's super important to use the unrefined organic cane sugar. It adds some complexity to the product for sure. A lot of the reason why conventional makers do use the refined cane sugar is because it's pure and white. It's been bleached. So you get, you tend to get a crisper, clearer looking preserve. So people eat with their eyes and they buy with their eyes. So I can understand that. But we'll take a little bit of a darker preserve that's produced by caramelization in exchange for knowing that we're getting something that is truly natural and not bad for us. So it's basically that unrefined organic cane sugar has trace elements of molasses and some of the different minerals and nutrients retained from the sugar cane. So it's not pure and white, and basically it has some elements in them that will caramelize quicker than that you wouldn't have with the bleached white sugar. So sometimes some of our preserves can be a little bit darker because of that. But it's really, you know, from our perspective, it just adds a complexity of flavor because you're caramelizing some of those nutrients and adding them in with the fruit.
Mm-hmm. Wow, yikes. It's, you know, it's crazy to think how, you know, how our food system has been engineered in this way. I always wondered how they got pesticides to only kill the bad and not the good. So it's, wow. I mean, the fact that it's engineered right in there, holy, that certainly is, it's cause for me to, I mean, I eat organically as well, and we always use natural cane sugar, and it's funny because in our recipes, sometimes I've had someone comment to me, where do they get that, and why do we use such exotic ingredients? And so, you know, it's just a mindset, and it is all about that education. So, you know, good for you, and thanks for that tidbit of knowledge. So we're coming up on sort of towards the end of the time that we have, but, you know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is you write as well in the beautiful prose that you have on, you know, on your website. You can tell that writing is close to your heart. But you talk about how watching the seasons and watching things grow and subsequently die back, and, you know, making the pain of things that happen in your life easier and more palatable, but that the fruit comes back year after year and the sweetness brings untold joy. And that really, to me, it emphasizes how deeply you feel connected to the earth and to your surroundings and how you nurture that connection. So how does this manifest for you, I'm curious, on a day-to-day? Or does it? Is it just part of you now?
Well, I'd say that it certainly has become part of me, but it's been a process. I mean, I didn't mention it earlier, but a big impetus for starting this business was the result of some personal struggles that I was going through in my life. when my husband and I moved out here, we were ready to start a family. We thought this was such an idyllic, perfect place to raise one. And that was 3 years ago. And so we enthusiastically started trying to start a family, and things didn't work out exactly the way we planned. You know, I was very surprised. It took a while to conceive, and then I very quickly had a miscarriage. Little did I know back then that this was going to become, dare I say, an important and consequential part of my life and part of my story. I then continued to have miscarriages. So I was at this point in my life where I really was certain that I wanted to start a family, and have that family experience, what I was learning about working with the land and working with this beautiful fruit. But the forces that be were not allowing it to happen. So I drew a lot of inspiration from the land around me. And when I eventually ended up starting the business, from the business, you know, just watching the natural evolution of things, you know, the movement of the seasons taught me a lot about the ebb and flow of life and how things die back and then they come back to life. And oftentimes it takes a unique combination of nurturing to get there. You know, for us, we actually ended up having 5 losses over the course of 3 years. And it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about myself. I think if I had not have had all those losses, I probably wouldn't have started this business. This business really was my baby. It was the baby that I couldn't have at the time. And yeah, there's a lot to be said for that. You know, it's I'm finally now, you know, pregnant for the 6th time, and we are due in less than a month. So we're expecting our miracle baby just through sheer determination. You know, eventually things just changed. And I don't know why. I don't know if it was the point we were in our life or if it just we needed that many times and needed to go through that to get where we are today. Mm-hmm. But looking back, it's interesting how life works. You know, you think things will go one way. And what I really learned from, you know, my experience is trying to start a family and starting this business and watching things grow and fall back and learning how to grow things is that you don't really have a whole lot of control. You just put your love and your faith in something and you nurture it and you do your best. And in the end, you know, there will be something born of that. It may not be what you anticipated in the beginning. So I've been pleasantly surprised. You know, what Girl Meets Dirt has become and, what it now means in my life and how it's changed me.
Thank you for that beautiful testament, Audra. it's, you know, it really is incredible. Life does send you on these tailspins sometimes. And, you know, similar to you, I also miscarried my first after the first trimester. And, you know, while that's not anywhere near the 5 that you experienced, what it did for me was I really felt shocked as to how badly I wanted to become a mother. It wasn't something, you know, before I was like, yeah, sure, I'd love to have a family. And, you know, you buy into the idea of it, but it wasn't until that shook me just to my very core that I realized how badly I wanted it. And I also started Pure Green during that time as well as a distraction. I think often, where would I be now if I had a 5-year-old and no Pure Green? You know, I think you go through things in a certain order for a reason, I guess, but I'm really glad to hear that your struggles are ending and that you're expecting your first. Congratulations. I'm so happy for you.
Yeah, we are thrilled.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to go through. But how do you envision life once your child comes along? What will happen with Girl Meets Dirt?
That is a really important, good question, Lean. you know, we have been just kind of rolling with the momentum of the business since it started, and you know, I've done a lot of marketing to help grow it, but over the past 6 months or so, I've really just kind of pulled back, and we did more than double production this season, so we're poised for growth. But we've been grateful that a lot of the new business has just kind of come naturally for us, so we haven't had to go out and grab it so much. So I've been kind of rolling with that and letting the business grow organically, if you will. And I think that's the plan moving forward. So, you know, I don't know what it's going to be like to be a mother. I know it is, you know, it's a priority for my husband and I, since we've put so much into this beautiful life that's about to come join us, that it will be priority. But I, you know, have visions of myself with my little baby strapped against my chest making jam. So I hope that it doesn't have to change much. You know, the business is kind of at a turning point where it's ready to grow. You know, I'm ready for my own kitchen space. So we talk a bit about having our own shop and commercial kitchen in Esound, which is the main town on the island, and starting to hire employees and really invest in different ways in the island economy. So that's where I see it going. But, you know, we're open to how things will change from here. You know, as I said, my first love is writing, too. So I also want to make sure that I find time for that and other types of projects. But, you know, the business isn't going anywhere anytime soon. Mm-hmm. But we're just going to have to figure out how to balance it, you know, like you have with a family, with a growing family.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I found that the transition for me was a little rocky, but that was because my expectations were out of whack. And it sounds to me like you're going into this really balanced, but, you know, it's going to take on a life of its own and you won't be able to anticipate it, but it's going to be beautiful and wonderful. So, you know, and I read at one point when Charlie, my daughter, was about 6 months old, and I was really struggling with the challenges of balancing it all and feeling like I wasn't hitting my stride and struggling with the guilt, you know, of wanting to be in two places at once. And I read that children should be at the center of life, not the center of life. And that really struck me because I realized that, you know, you know, everything I do is about Charlie now, but at the same time, I don't have to be, you know, helicopter parenting or whatever you want to call it. She can ride the wave with me. She can come to work and she can, you know, if she's happily playing, I could do things. And it's just, I don't know. I think that it's an interesting way to look at things. I've really embraced that since then. And it made a huge, huge difference.
I think that's beautifully put. I just actually wrote that down. You know, I feel like my mother raised me to be a very independent person, and it's very important to me to raise a child like that. And I think it takes a village, number one. And it's okay to have the child experience a mother who's involved in all sorts of different things. I mean, I am grateful that I don't have a conventional job. I'll say that, you know, especially in the U.S., given, you know, a whole other conversation about the lack of maternity leave support. It's a little better in Canada. But I'm grateful that I do have my own business for that reason, that I can have flexibility in raising my child more the way that I want and having them be at the center of life, like you said, and not the center, and really grow well-rounded human beings.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I know it's funny. You do tend, I don't know. I mean, I guess when you're in the middle of something and you're struggling with something, it's natural to focus on the difficulties. But the awesome thing about having your business is that flexibility. You can work at night. You can, like, squeeze things in on their naps, and that's really helpful. So, yeah, it does really help.
But then again, you're on your own, right?
Yeah, I know. That's the worst part because then, you know, I'm always thinking about, you know, my email inbox is my enemy. It's my arch enemy. And if I'm not doing the work, nobody is. And so it certainly adds to the stress, but well, you know, that flexibility, it ebbs and flows. So it certainly, it has its bonuses. So in my final question to you, I wanted to circle back to the beginning and ask what your advice would be to someone looking to undergo a dramatic shift in their life like you did.
Oh, boy.
I know. That's now, a big question.
Oh, it's a great question. You know, it's, some of our friends in Manhattan still to this day think we're crazy. but most of the people in our lives, you know, a few years in, so it's been, we're coming on 4 years now since the big upheaval. And most of them are now actually pretty convinced that we did the right thing. I mean, we absolutely know that we did the right thing. It's taken us a little while to get on our feet and really settle into a groove, but we feel like we're finally in a place that is sustainable. And that's what we wanted. We wanted to live, you know, in a place that was life affirming, and have work that was meaningful and sustainable, and allow ourselves to really grow roots somewhere. So I guess my advice would be to dive in. I feel like life is too short. You know, it's so easy to get wrapped up into the rat race and the chasing after one new thing after the next. And in the end, it's really not important. You know, my husband always says, you can't take it to the grave with you. And, you know, we're not particularly spiritual or religious people, but, you know, we do believe in living each day to its fullest. And I think the only way to do that is if you want to be somewhere else, get yourself there. You know, on a practical side, don't forget to plan a bit. You know, we saved up some money to be prepared for what we might go through. And so that's a really important part, is build yourself a small little nest egg and make plans, and then make it happen as soon as you can. And learn to live with uncertainty. I mean, the uncertainty ends up teaching you so much about yourself. And you never know where it's going to lead you. I had no idea. If you asked me 4 years ago if I would have seen myself here today living on Orcas Island running a business called Girl Meets Dirt, where I make specialty preserves from heirloom fruit, I would have said, oh, it sounds great, but yeah, right. So you just have to kind of take what you're given and take a risk. Take that risk, because I think it'll, you know, you can always turn around. You can always go back if it doesn't work out. I mean, that was our saving grace, is we felt, you know what, if this doesn't work out, we can always move back to New York and get the same old types of jobs. We can always go move to a city and try and make it work. But, you know, this was the real challenge. And I'm just incredibly grateful that we took that risk, because we've never been happier, never been happier.
Oh, I am so glad that we got to end on that sentiment, because, yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful way to end. And so let me just say thank you very much for being, for taking part in this, Audra. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much for taking the time to do it. It was my pleasure.
That concludes my talk with Audra. I hope it carried you away for a little while as you listened. As I mentioned in the introduction, we also featured Audra in Volume 10, The Heritage Issue, where you can further be inspired by Audra through Sonia's beautiful, moody imagery in all their printed glory. You can subscribe at puregreenmag.com/subscribe. As a small, independent publisher, we need new subscribers to keep us going. And if you're already a subscriber, then thank you. Your support and readership is immensely valued and appreciated. I hope you have a fantastic week ahead. I'm Celine McKay, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Pure Green Podcast.